This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
Mid-October football, and we are in the 90s here at Austin, Texas.
Asher Price was one of approximately 97,000 fans in the stadium when the University of Texas played Kansas in October of last year.
The crowd was overflowing with burnt orange and white T-shirts, and people were holding aloft their hook'em horns.
You know, hook'em horns. That's when Texas fans hold up their pointer and little fingers and tuck the middle and ring fingers under their thumbs. Anyway, it was pretty much your average home football game at UT until halftime.
The 1969 National Championship University of Texas Longhorn football team was recognized on the field. The band was serenading them. The crowd was cheering them on.
The band was serenading them. Do you remember what they were playing?
I think they played "The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You." So this is, you know, the school fight song. And so the crowd was presenting their hook'em horns to the players on the field, and the players on the field were holding their hook'em horns aloft back up to the crowd. It was actually, in many ways, a touching scene. I mean, here were these guys being feted for their boyhood triumphs. And it just happens that because of the policies of the University of Texas in the 1950s through the 1960s, even after integration, this group of men happened to be all white. The 1969 National Championship University of Texas Longhorn football team was the last all-white team to win the national championship.
Was there any attempt to acknowledge the sort of awkwardness of this situation?
No, none at all. To me, in the stands, that was troubling. You know, the University of Texas has a complicated relationship with its past. In some ways, it's been taking it head on. It's, in recent years, removed Confederate memorials from campus. But it remains a touchy subject at the University of Texas about how to handle these issues.
And this scene was especially troubling to Asher Price, because over the past few years, he's been researching and writing a book about Earl Campbell, an African-American running back who played for the Longhorns in the mid to late 70s, not long after the University of Texas finally integrated their football team. As part of his research, Asher requested boxes of documents from the University of Texas off-site archive.
And these librarians come with these gloves and hand them carefully to you, and you start looking through the boxes and their folders that say things like Negroes in colleges.
Wow.
And you start going through these documents, and they're shocking. They spell out the very deliberative, bureaucratic way that people in power at the University of Texas, after the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954, how they tried to prevent black students from enrolling at the University of Texas, and then how to keep them from being graduate teaching assistants, how to keep them off the football team. It's not surprising, maybe, that these institutions did everything they could to resist integration, but there is real power in these documents in illuminating how people behind closed doors tried to maintain segregation and how they went about in a very methodical manner to try to keep the status quo.
So, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled in the spring of 1954, and that ruling required educational institutions to integrate their classrooms. Tell me about Marion Ford. Who was he, and why did he want to go to UT?
Marion Ford is a charismatic black kid from Houston. He's 17 years old in 1954. He's a top-notch swimmer. He writes for the newspaper. He's in the Chemistry Honor Society. And he goes to an all-black high school in Houston. He also plays football.
The very first time that Marion Ford applied, he wasn't immediately accepted into the university. So at first he said he wanted to be a chemistry major, right?
That's right. Marion Ford wants to be a chemistry major at the University of Texas. And the dean of admissions writes him back saying, you can take chemistry and the introductory courses at an all-black school in Houston. And Marion Ford writes him back saying, I think he says, I want to be actually a chemistry engineering major, and there is no such course available at this school in Houston.
Here's a direct quote from the letter Marion Ford sent to the dean of admissions. I am not interested in living in your dormitories or becoming socially prominent with the Caucasians, but I do want a chance to get the best formal training in my state.
I mean, can you imagine being a 16 or 17-year-old kid engaging in a correspondence with the dean of admissions of the flagship university? And so finally, the dean of admissions relents, but he sends him this completely condescending letter of admission saying, you have to get over your inferiority complex.
Here are the dean of admissions' actual words. I hope that you do well in the university and that you will get over your inferiority complex and the idea that you are being discriminated against. And with that, Marion Ford became one of about a half dozen African-American students who were admitted to the University of Texas in the summer of 1954. And that's where the real trouble started for Marion Ford.
He's interviewed by a Houston reporter about being one of the first black students admitted to the University of Texas. You imagine, it's a big deal. And so he gives this interview, and one of the things he says is, I would love to try out for the Longhorn football team. Now, one of the people who reads this story, actually is asked for comment, is a regent, University of Texas regent. And he says, well, we'll have to see what's in the best interest of the university. That's his on-the-record comment. But privately, he's alarmed. He gets in touch with the chair of the Board of Regents. This is the body that oversees the University of Texas. And the chair of the Board of Regents quickly writes to the state attorney general. They huddle, and the decision they arrive at is to rescind the admission of not only Marion Ford, but all the other black students that they had admitted that summer of 1954. And Marion Ford has refunded his $20 that he had plonked down for his dorm room, an all-black dorm room, I should add, at the University of Texas.
As a consequence of Marion Ford telling a reporter that he wanted to play football for the UT Longhorns, the school placed a moratorium on black student admissions. Ford was told to enroll in one of the state's all-black schools instead. He could apply to UT again once he'd finished his introductory courses.
And during that year, the university puts together a select committee involving a few professors and high-ranking administrators, and they decide to adopt SATs, basically, selective admissions test, to, again, exclude as many African Americans as possible. And in these documents, they include, like, math worksheets, basically, a calculation of if they set the SAT cutoff score at such and such a level, they're likely to suppress the number of African Americans that enroll at the university.
And those calculations also show the disproportionate way in which that testing would affect black students and white students, right?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. These are chilling documents.
As you're going through all these documents and reading them one by one, what comes to mind for you? What is that like for you?
I mean, these documents are delicate. They're in this onion skin paper, and in a perverse sort of way, they're beautiful documents. They're kind of carefully written, handsomely written, but they're also stomach-turning and disturbing, of course. It makes me think of the heroism, actually, of these black students who are trying to enter the University of Texas.
How did the university sort of respond to you unearthing these documents? Had they been hoping no one would see them?
To their credit, they didn't hide under a stone. They gave the line that it's our responsibility because of this racist history. I mean, they called it out for what it was. It's our responsibility to step up to the plate and to have progressive admissions policies and to engage these things head on.
After sending Marion Ford and the other African-American students away in the summer of 1954, Ford and a few others were allowed to enroll in the fall of 1956. And that fall, USC was scheduled to come to Austin to play the Longhorns. They had a running back named Cornelius Roberts.
Cornelius Roberts is known as the Chocolate Rocket. He's a black football player at USC. And so they have this problem. They have Cornelius Roberts coming, and there's a memo from the dean of students, the University of Texas president, about what we're going to do about African-American fans who want to come watch the game, and they decide that they'll have separate seating sections, of course. And they go on in such minute detail about how to keep blacks and whites separate. How are we going to sell hot dogs to these people but not these people? This is the kind of level on which these administrators are operating. Anyway, USC, Cornelius Roberts kind of runs roughshod over the University of Texas. They crush them. This is University of Texas is 1956, is on its way to a 1-9 season. Marion Ford is now in the stands, is part of this first group of students who are finally allowed to enroll in the university. And he goes down to the beleaguered UT football coach, a guy named Ed Price, and says, you know, you really could use me out there. Let me try out for the team. And he says, no dice. It's not going to happen. It's not in my hands. He doesn't allow Ford to try out for the team. And it won't be until 1970 that a black player is allowed to play at the University of Texas.
So how did that come to be? How and why did the University of Texas finally integrate its football team?
That's a great question. And in a way, it's a long story. But the short of it is that Darrell Royal, who takes over from Ed Price, this mediocre football coach, and kind of revives the University of Texas football program, he ultimately, as the early 1970s roll around, late 1960s and early 1970s, wants to make sure he puts the most competitive team on the field. So on one hand, and we can bracket this, it's about winning. But by the time 1970 rolls around, Darrell Royal has presided over an all-white team for at least a dozen years, and they've been pretty successful. But Royal himself is starting to worry about his legacy. He had become close friends with Lyndon Baines Johnson, who is urging him to do more to help black students on campus. Darrell Royal is maybe the most powerful person on the University of Texas campus. He's led the Longhorns to national championships. He's been given a full professorship by the Regents. He's secure. And so it's really on his shoulders whether he wants to allow black players at UT or not.
In some ways, Marion Ford is sort of the hero of our little story here. So what happened to him? Did he ever get that degree in chemical engineering?
Marion Ford actually became a dentist. He settled in Houston. He had a very successful practice. And funny enough, he, through the end of his life, he was a devoted UT fan. He loved going to UT alumni meetups in Houston. He was a big fan of the football team. That's the kind of other thing that is really fascinating about a lot of the early black admits to the University of Texas, is that they're quite loyal to the university. They're proud of the university, even as they're mindful of the history in which they participated.
Asher Price is the author of Earl Campbell, Yards After Contact. We'll have a link at our website, onlyagame.org. During the 2014 Minnesota Boys Basketball Tournament, Hopkins High School coach Ken Novak had an idea.
With that situation, we can't lose. We only can win. And that's a good situation to have.
What was his can't lose plan? That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Need more good news in your podcast feed? Listen to Kind World, a podcast from WBUR, where we share how an act of kindness can transform lives. New episodes on Tuesdays. Subscribe to Kind World now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. Tom Brady will soon be a free agent, which seems to be of interest to various NFL fans around the country.
Las Vegas would love to have you here at the Raiders.
Would you want him to come to L.A. and play for the Rams?
We need you, Tom. Don't leave us with a massive hole to fill. Brady, come back!
And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo Sports. Welcome back, Hannah.
Thank you for having me.
And by Will Leach, contributing editor to New York Magazine. Welcome back, Will.
An honor as always, Karen.
I think this goes without saying, but I am super excited to have you both back, but I will not sing about it, okay?
Are you sure?
We'll see. We got a lot of time left to go on this show.
We are about 10 days away from the day Patriots fans have been dreading since Tom Brady took over as a starter in 2001. And add to the drama the speculation that arose this week that Brady could end up in San Francisco playing for his childhood team, the 49ers. And New England fans are really, really losing their minds. I mean, it's hard to imagine Tom and Giselle agreeing to live in Tennessee, but San Francisco. On the other hand, I have friends who are Raiders fans in particular, and they're wringing their hands over the idea that Brady could end up there. They're actually questioning whether they could keep cheering for their team if the dreaded Tom Brady was at the helm. From an entertainment point of view, this is all a whole lot of fun. But from the point of view of a Patriots fan, I'm not liking it, not a single little bit. Hannah, please tell me this is all going to be okay.
I wish I could. because I like you a lot, Karen.
Thank you.
But because one of my least favorite things ever is free agent speculation. Mm. You're always being manipulated. Like, right. If someone leaks to you that he's thinking about coming somewhere. And my favorite thing, on the flip side, is career team players. And maybe people who understand football can explain this better to me. Why doesn't he just retire? Why doesn't he go out on top as a career Patriot?
Will, do you want to give it a try?
Listen, sources say that Hannah is totally right about this free agent speculation, yes, sort of business. Several sources, unnamed, but close to the situation. For me, you know, there's two things on this. One, I like the idea of Brady going to Vegas because it's really every middle-aged man eventually gets there, right? Like, that's kind of, like it's a matter of time. Think of it just almost as retiring in the West. And two, to me, the best part about this is, and the thing that worries me, honestly, Karen, the most,
yeah,
is I'm a little concerned that this kind of speculation and worry is going to cause Boston sports fans to act erratically.
Okay, Hannah, you've been forced to follow a different sports obsession. Please fill us in.
Okay, so I have just gotten back from spring training. I finished my Florida stint, which, if you can believe it, was spent almost exclusively in West Palm Beach, which is where the Astros play, because that is the story that will not die. And as this story has sort of become increasingly complicated, I've noticed that there are a couple of points on which people don't, I don't want to say they're getting it wrong, but it just sort of seems like there are some hang-ups. So I want to address a couple of them very quickly. I'll talk fast. Something I'm seeing a lot, people saying that Manfred should punish the players. There has been like public outrage that the Astros all got off scot-free. Rob Manfred himself called the banging scheme player-driven, although I'm sure the PA would like us all to stop reminding people of that. And in doing so, it made a lot of fans feel like any sort of sanctions were incomplete if they didn't include the players. But in that initial memo that Manfred put out about the investigation, he explained that it would both be unnecessary and complicated and likely unsuccessful if they tried to punish the players because the union would grieve each suspension, and there would end up being basically 25 different investigations, and that's too much. But perhaps even more important to point out, they couldn't punish the players. After the whole Apple Watch thing with the Red Sox in 2017, Manfred put out a statement basically saying that they were going to hold front offices accountable for any teams cheating. So it's not like a moral thing. They are probably going to make it possible to punish players in the future, which pretty much just means that next time players cheat and they get punished, we will once again have people angry about the fact that the Astros weren't punished. Sorry, that was a lot of information at once, and that was only point one. Let's stop there for now, and I'll let somebody else talk.
Will, what do you make of this?
Well, you know, welcome back from spring training, Hannah. I've been reading a lot of your coverage over there, living vicariously. And my favorite piece that you wrote was this piece interviewing a bunch of Astros fans. And I love this because there is something kind of wonderful about, you ask these first two or three questions of them, and they're all like, yep, it was cheating, and I'm disappointed. And then you ask them the logical question, okay, so are you going to stop rooting for the cheating cheaters who cheated? And they're like, what are you, insane? Of course not. I'm going to root harder. And there's something very deeply American and sports fandom-y about that kind of idea that, like, I will cheer harder for them and circle the wagons and love them more than I ever have.
I mean, maybe it shouldn't be surprising that I related to that as a Patriots fan. I'm a little bit used to people accusing my team of cheating. But Hannah, what surprised me in reading what you've been writing from Florida is that I really found myself feeling for Josh Reddick and the others Astros whose families are actually facing death threats over all of this. I mean, yes, it's absolutely wrong to steal signs, but that's absolutely not justification for telling a father that you hope his 5-year-old son gets cancer.
Five months.
Oh,
I mean,
my
don't hope 5-year-olds get cancer. This gets to one of the other points that I wanted to clarify, which is I'm seeing a lot of like, well, if only they would apologize. And here's the thing. You do not have to accept their apology, but they have apologized.
Right.
Like, I just want to disabuse listeners of the notion that you will feel better if the Astros apologize. You won't. And maybe it's because you don't believe that they're sorry. And if that's your stance, by all means. But I have talked to them. I listened to Josh Reddick tell us about the death threats. And even before that, like, they did say that they understand that they cheated and that they are sorry.
All right, Will, you're up.
I'm a graduate of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Go Illini. This week, students at my school voted on the belted kingfisher, a bird that is orange and blue, the school colors, that is native to the state of Illinois. And the students are voting whether or not it's going to be the new mascot. But there's been a massive amount of resistance to this pure, cute, very sweet little bird. And the reason is because the University of Illinois in 2007 got rid of their former mascot, Chief Illiniwek. Now, as you can probably tell from the name of Chief Illiniwek, Chief Illiniwek was one of those ugly Native American offshoot mascots. I can tell you, as someone that covered the Illinois basketball team when I was there, Chief Illiniwek was usually portrayed by a blonde-haired, blue-eyed frat guy named Chad. And Chad was always whooping it up and doing this very, very ugly dance at halftime. And eventually, Illinois, under pressure of the NCAA, got rid of the mascot. As professional teams and universities have gotten rid of these offensive mascots, you've actually found a certain segment of the fan base, usually older, usually whiter, that is not only fighting back against that, they're actually claiming that part of their heritage has been taken away. The Atlanta Braves, they've encouraged the chop, even during the playoffs last year, when Ryan Helsley, a pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals, who is of Cherokee Nation, said that he'd found it offensive. They said they would not do it for that game. But then, after the Cardinals won that game, Georgia lawmakers from the GOP actually said it was karma that the Braves lost because they'd gotten rid of the chop that game. And by all accounts, the chop will be coming back for 2020.
Hannah, what do you make of this?
The All-Star game last year was in Cleveland Indians. That same year, conveniently, the Indians stopped selling merch with Chief Wahoo on it. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really striking how hard it was to tell that that had happened. And this is interesting with the Braves and with the way that they sort of accepted that if someone who was actually of Cherokee descent was bothered by it, then they were like, well, yeah, of course, we won't play it while you're there, which is in some ways the worst possible response because it makes it seem like he's a sensitive baby for taking issue with it, and they're kind of like snickering behind his back. It feels a little bit like that, and it feels like fans are kind of doing that. We're already getting backlash to backlash in the fact that people are like, ugh, can you believe we had to not do it for one game? That makes me want to do it even more.
I mean, it does sometimes feel like we're going backwards here. And we've been following a story not far from here in Killingly, Connecticut. Last summer, the school board voted to remove the Red Men as the school's mascot. And residents were so upset about this that they voted in a bunch of new school board members. They voted in a new school board, and the new school board voted to bring back the Red Men.
Listen, I grew up an Illinois basketball fan. I remember watching the Chief when I was 8, and perhaps, you know, I will say that at 8 years old in rural Illinois, I was not particularly woke. I loved the Chief. I thought the Chief was great. Then you get older and you learn and you meet the guy named Chad who's like, what's up, bro? I'm the Chief. I'm like, oh, I hate the Chief now. To me, that's part of the process of growing up and learning how the world is larger than what you realize it is. I find it telling, however, that particularly at Illinois and a lot of these schools, students just want to move on. Mm-hmm. They don't want to see these people with the Chief shirts. It's the older people that are ruining everything.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo Sports and Will Leach, contributing editor to New York Magazine. Thanks to both of you.
Of course.
Thank you. Fun as always.
This time of year, thousands of high school basketball players are competing in state tournaments. These games can become the stuff of local legend, the big comeback, the otherworldly performance, the tournament-winning shot. But one game, held 6 years ago at the Minnesota Boys Basketball Tournament, is remembered for what didn't happen. Only a Game's Jonathan Chang has the story.
Since 2000, Hopkins High School has won 8 boys' state basketball titles. Back in 2014, their roster featured a future NBA player and multiple future Division I athletes. Entering that year's Minnesota State Tournament, Hopkins was one of the favorites, and they quickly advanced to the semifinal game.
Hopkins averaged about 88 points a game that year, and they just were a high-octane, just fast-paced juggernaut.
That's John Miller. He was an assistant coach at Shakopee High School, Hopkins' semifinal opponent in 2014. Hopkins head coach Ken Novak says Shakopee played a very different style.
They played a slow-down game, and generally their scores were probably in the 40s and 50s, and so it was definitely a big contrast.
I mean, the betting odds were us not to probably be within 15, 20 points that game.
But Miller had a strategy to give a slower, underdog team a chance, the zone defense. That's when each player guards an area of the court instead of a player. Shakopee players would pack in close to the basket they were defending, and they weren't going to leave. On March 13th, the two teams met for the semifinal game at the Target Center, the home of the NBA's Minnesota Timberwolves. Ken Novak says there were about 14,000 fans in the arena. And Shakopee's zone was working against the favored Hopkins team.
We weren't necessarily hitting shots, and we weren't getting clean looks. It was pretty back and forth.
That's Kamali Chambers, who is Hopkins' senior point guard. With 2 minutes and 43 seconds left in the second half, the game was tied at 41 points. Kamali brought up the ball for Hopkins.
And I was just tired at this point, so like coach, he wanted us to get in our motion, and he gave the hand signal for it.
But Kamali didn't run the play his coach was calling for. Instead, he just stood there. No one was coming up to pressure him, so Kamali figured he'd catch a breather.
And then, like, after 30 seconds of it, I kind of looked over to coach, and he kind of gave me his little laugh. He kind of just sat back, and then at that point, I just knew that we're going to take the last shot of the game.
See, in the Minnesota High School State Basketball Tournament, there is no shot clock. That means teams can hold on to the ball indefinitely. So for the next 2 minutes, Kamali just held on to the ball. And Shakopee just hung back in their zone that had worked the whole game.
And so it was like the battle of wills.
With just 19 seconds left in regulation, Hopkins got the ball to sophomore guard Amir Coffey. Coffey took the shot, but the floater missed.
Well, after regulation ended, that's when coach said, we're going to win the tip. And when we win the tip, we're just going to take the last shot.
In other words, if Hopkins won the tip, they'd hold the ball for nearly all 5 minutes of overtime and take the last shot.
With that situation, we can't lose. We only can win. And that's a good situation to have.
Hopkins did win the tip. Kamali dribbled the ball just past half court, and Shakopee didn't pressure.
Now, the overtime's 5 minutes. So 5 minutes is a long time to hold the ball.
In the closing seconds, a Hopkins layup was blocked. And Kamali's desperation three-pointer also missed. In the next overtime, Hopkins won the tip again. Now, if you're thinking that either of these teams might switch up its plan, you're wrong. Shakopee still didn't leave the zone, and Kamali again held on to the ball. This time, Hopkins maybe stalled a little too long. They didn't get a shot up before the buzzer went off. By this point, the fans were getting pretty frustrated with a basketball game featuring about as much action as watching the court get mopped. And they were booing. Then in the third overtime, mercifully, Shakopee finally got the ball.
They won the tip, and then we knew that we were going to play.
It had been 12 minutes since either team had scored. And unlike Hopkins, Shakopee didn't stall for a final shot. They took a 44-41 lead right off the bat.
When they scored, I would say, like, you thought it would be a game seven of the finals. Somebody hit a big shot. It kind of erupted.
Late in the third overtime, Hopkins tied the game with a corner three-pointer. The two teams were headed to a fourth overtime. Hopkins won the tip again, and everyone knew what was coming up next. For more than 4.5 minutes, Kamali would hold the ball near half court. In the final 16 seconds...
And this is their shooter, and he stepped out of bounds with 5.9. Jacob Wright, foot went out of bounds.
That's the second... An opportunity lost. Shakopee now had the ball. The game was tied at 46. Coming out of a timeout, Kamali was set up at half court. His job was to make sure that none of the 5 Shakopee players got behind him for an easy basket. But as he waited for Shakopee to inbound, he could only count 4 players in front of him.
And then I was looking for the 5th, and I was like, oh no, he's behind me.
One of the Shakopee players had snuck away for what appeared to be a wide open pass to the basket.
The inbound of the ball, and I just sprinted like in a full-out sprint.
Kamali was able to get there just in time to steal the pass. And Hopkins called timeout with 2 seconds left in the 4th overtime. After sticking with the zone the entire game, Shakopee assistant John Miller wondered if he should switch things up now. But he thought,
why would I do something different when this has been super effective? And I'm thinking worst case scenario. So I'm like, okay, they're going to get it. They're going to just pretty much have a 3-quarter court heave to the basket, and we're going to go to 5th overtime.
With 2 seconds on the clock, Hopkins inbounded to one of its best players.
Here's Amir Coffey from a long way. Got it! Coffey into the state title game on that 50-footer. Wow. That's a 50-foot shot, Dave.
What were you thinking when that ball went up in the air?
You're like, there's no way. No one in a state tournament game, no one hits something like that.
The final score, 49-46 Hopkins. Hopkins was going to the 2014 state title game.
It was heartbreaking. It's still, it's been 6 years and I still have kind of flashbacks and nightmares about what should I have done, what could we have done.
Hopkins won, but not because of their ball stalling.
That's the irony of it. It's not like the strategy ended up working.
After the game, many called for Minnesota basketball to adopt the shot clock. But 6 years later, they still haven't. Maybe it's just more fun that way.
That's Only at Games, Jonathan Chang. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and I am the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. I am so excited because we are working on a bunch of new, amazing episodes. We're exploring big ideas about reinvention, making amends, and the psychological effects of climate change. Our first show drops March 13th. Please join me.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, a young artist takes shots of Crown Royal with the octogenarian alums of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen. I never get assignments like that. It's terrible.
Steph Curry is back and all is well with the world, right?
Well, all is well with the world next year. Mm. The Warriors can start the rebuilding process now. There's been a hole in the season this year.
On Thursday night, Steph tallied 23 points, 7 assists, and 7 rebounds. The Warriors lost. But as Coach Steve Kerr said before the game, everybody is excited, more excited than we should be for a team that's 14-48. How long can that excitement last?
Well, I think with Steph Curry, it's just a matter of going to the game to see what he can do at this point. Nobody has any illusions about the Warriors as a championship contender this year. But Steph Curry is worth the price of admission whenever he plays.
Meanwhile, all is not well in New York. After a kerfuffle with Madison Square Garden security on Monday, Knicks superfan Spike Lee has said he will not return this season. Now fans not named Spike Lee are staying away, too. What's going on?
Well, the Knicks stink. There's nothing fans can do about it. There's nothing the media can do about it unless the owner steps off a cliff the way Marv Schott did in Cincinnati. You can't do anything about a bad owner until he gets bored with the product and sells it.
Well, in this case, Lee was stopped on his way into the garden and told that he had entered through the staff and media door. Lee says he's been using that entrance for 28 years. And by the way, over that time, he spent $10 million for courtside seats. The Knicks say they've repeatedly asked him to stop using that entrance and use the VIP entrance instead. It really seems like this should have been resolved much more easily.
If Spike would rather be a member of the press than a VIP, I'm right down with that. I really am. By the way, $10 million for courtside seats? Oh, my God.
We are almost to the madness of March, Charlie. Who are you liking in the men's game?
I have developed a real fondness for your number three ranked Dayton Flyers because, number one, they haven't been there in a while. Number two, they have a great player in Obi Toppin. And number three, if you've ever been to a game at Dayton, you'll know what I mean. There's a reason why the tournament puts the first four there every year. It's because those people are some of the greatest basketball fans in the world. I think Kansas is probably the best team in the country. I don't believe in Baylor or San Diego State. But if I'm cheering for anybody beyond my own alma mater, which, please God, will get off the bubble, I'm cheering for the Dayton Flyers.
On the women's side, South Carolina tops the AP poll, followed by Baylor, Oregon, and Louisville. UConn is back in the top five after dropping down briefly earlier this season. And I'm sure breaking that streak of 353 weeks in the top five wasn't fun for Huskies fans, but parity is good for the game, don't you think?
Parity is terrific for the game, and the skill level of women's basketball amazes me every year because it goes up by an order of magnitude.
USA Gymnastics has made a settlement offer of $217 million in the Larry Nassar abuse case. By taking this offer, survivors would agree not to hold the U.S. Olympic Committee, USA Gymnastics, its former chief executive, or Marta or Bella Caroli responsible for the abuse they suffered for years. It's a lot of money, but this case isn't really about the money, is it?
Well, it's about the money for some people, and that shouldn't be overlooked. Some of the people who aren't Allie Raisman or Simone Biles and the other people who are fighting the settlement, you know, they have bills to pay, probably therapist bills running into the tens of thousands of dollars, and they could use the money. This isn't an easy question. It's one thing to immunize the organizations, but the Carolis, that's way out of bounds. That shouldn't happen. Those people should be made to pay a price.
Chicago State and the University of Missouri, Kansas City became the first schools to cancel games in Seattle because of coronavirus concerns. I say they were the first because I expect by the time the weekend is through, we'll be hearing about a lot more cancellations.
Oh, as we get closer to the tournament, and I would point out tournaments because there are men's and women's tournaments at every level that all happen at the same time. I think you're seeing more and more of that. I've covered a couple of games in empty arenas. Mm. It's truly weird.
Yeah.
Because number one, you've forgotten how noisy playing basketball is. The squeak of the sneakers, guys yelling out switches and talking to each other and stuff. And of course, the usual fan dance with the referees. I would prepare for that, too, if I were the NCAA.
And finally, Charlie, well, Alex Trebek is here with our final question.
Joel Embiid in 2019 won the trademark for this nickname of his that also describes the 76ers' strategy of improving the team. Paul.
What is do a 180?
Nope.
I mean, come on. That's not even a good guess.
Man. But we must give Joel Embiid credit. He's embracing it. He knows his social media. He tweeted out an entirely new nickname. Joel, quote, do a 180 Embiid with a bunch of question marks at the end.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Last weekend in Atlanta, Molly Seidel crossed the starting line of her first ever marathon. It was the U.S. Olympic Trials. 2 hours, 27 minutes, and 31 seconds later, Molly Seidel qualified for the Olympics. And while Seidel's second-place finish certainly came out of nowhere, she is a professional runner, sponsored by a shoe company, and she did have the benefit of spending the past 2 months at altitude preparing for the race. The athlete at the center of our next story didn't have any of that. It begins a while back, with this woman.
Chris Clark from Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm a pathologist and a marathon runner, though I haven't done a marathon for, gosh, maybe 19 years.
Here's reporter Cherie Turner.
Back in 2000, when our story takes place, Chris Clark didn't just do marathons. She was a serious athlete. She'd run fast enough to qualify for the 2000 Olympic Trials Marathon, where the winner of the race would automatically earn a spot on the U.S. Olympic team. But Chris knew her chances of winning the trials were about 0%. She had been working with a coach, but other than that, her running life was very different from the top U.S. marathon runners. She wasn't sponsored. She was a wife and mother of two young boys. She worked 3 days a week at a medical center. And she was 37, one of the oldest runners in the race. But Chris was a fan of the Olympics, going back to childhood.
Look for Madeline Manning Jackson, gold medal winner, 72 Olympics.
Oh, I was an Olympic junkie. Gosh, I watched every summer Olympics, every 4 years growing up. I don't know that I actually ever had real aspirations of being Olympian, but I think everyone who watches the Olympics sort of has that inner dream of being an Olympian one day.
Through high school and college, Chris ran track and cross country, and she'd been competitive, fast enough to earn a scholarship to Montana State University, but she had other priorities.
And after college, I went to medical school and basically just did recreational running, you know, what time allowed for.
And Chris's first marathon, it wasn't even her idea.
My husband had qualified for the Boston Marathon, and he cajoled me into training for my first marathon.
As Chris describes it, she was not in marathon shape. So she did an accelerated training program, and at the Napa Valley Marathon, she ran fast enough to get into Boston.
6 weeks later, we went to Boston and ran the Boston Marathon. Then we didn't run a marathon again for a long time.
After her medical residency, Chris moved with her husband and their two young boys to Anchorage, and she managed to find ways to keep running.
Had a running stroller and put the kids in the running stroller, and we started running more with the kids, and I got stronger, and we were doing local running races. Anchorage is a very active community. It's sort of a truncated running season just because we have a very long winter here, but at some point, I got reconnected with running marathons again.
Chris got stronger and faster. She qualified for the 1996 Olympic Trials Marathon, where she placed 76th. Headed into the 2000 trials, she set reasonable goals for herself.
I think I've seen it in the top 25. And I remembered from the first time I had gone that the top 20 went to the podium. They had a ceremony after the race, and the top 20 were honored. So that was my goal. And I thought, oh, if I had a really great day, I could make it into the top 10.
Chris's best marathon time was 12 minutes slower than the top qualifier. Also, the trials were in February, and Chris lived in Alaska. She spent a lot of time training on the treadmill at home. Chris was disciplined, but she trained less than most elite marathoners did. She was running 60 to 70 miles a week, while they were putting in 30 to 40 miles more. And then there was this. The trials were in South Carolina, where it's hot and the course was hilly.
I didn't worry about the hills because I changed the elevation on my treadmill. And I didn't worry about the weather because I planned on hydrating thoroughly on the course. I have a really strong mindset, and I don't get rattled by things like that. So those kind of variables don't really bother me. I knew we were all doing the same thing.
On race day, Chris lined up with 170 other women. The field included favorites like top qualifier Libby Hickman, sub-233 marathoner Christy Johnston, and Anne-Marie Lauck, who'd placed 10th at the 1996 Olympic Marathon.
I really wasn't all that focused on them because I just felt like I had come to do my own race.
The leaders went out faster than Chris had planned to go.
A couple of those women I know got out of sight, and that didn't bother me. You know, that happens in every race, and you just let those people get away. You got to run your own pace.
The temperature climbed to over 80 degrees. It was humid, but Chris remained steady. She stuck to her 5-minute, 47-second pace as other runners began to fade. By mile 17, there was only one person ahead of her, former Olympian Lauk, who'd been on a solo flyer since around mile 4.
I think I caught Anne-Marie Lauk at about mile 20, and right after I caught her, I went by my coach, and I gave him the thumbs-up sign, and he gave me the thumbs-up sign, and I felt just fine at that point. I really just felt strong and confident, and, you know, it was a good feeling.
But Chris also knew anything can happen in a marathon. You can run out of energy, you can cramp, nausea is common, especially in the heat. But Chris kept powering through those last miles. Her lead looked solid.
But I'm curious, like, what must have been going on through your mind as you were, like, running these last few miles out front?
Oh, gosh, I was really excited. Somewhat incredulity, because I sure didn't expect to be there at that point, holding it all together. But I also had faith in myself, and I felt strong.
And so as you're approaching the finish line, like, at what point did you realize, like, I'm going to win this thing? And did it sink in at that time that, like, I'm going to win this and I'm going to the Olympics?
Yeah, you know, the last, gosh, half mile at least is on a straightaway. And I did turn around, and I realized there was no one behind me. And yeah, I was almost in tears. And by the time I got to the finish line, I was in tears. And I did realize I was going to the Olympics. And I can't even tell you how exciting that moment was.
Chris had gone into this race hoping for a top 20 place, maybe top 10. And she'd finished first. She'd improved her fastest marathon time by over 7 minutes in tough conditions. And she'd won a spot on the Olympic team.
I think I was just bawling there for a little bit because it was, you know, like I said, I was this kid who grew up watching the Olympics every 4 years. And then all of a sudden, it was me going, and no one ever thought it was going to be me going.
Chris soon found herself in another unexpected position at the center of a press conference. It was another first for her.
Yeah, that was kind of a surreal moment, too, because I think there were all these women in the room who were looking at me like, who is this person? Because you know, they all knew each other. So I think they're all looking at me like, how did she win this?
The word began to spread that a 37-year-old doctor, wife, and mother of two from Alaska had won the Olympic trials.
And then I just got a lot of letters from working moms about what a great inspiration you were. And this just gives me such hope. It gets me out of bed in the morning. And I got them from men, too. Honestly, there's cross-country skiers here in town who were Olympians who thought that their Olympic careers were over at age 35. And then I did this, and they said, you know, I'm going to go back and give it another shot because you could do this, and I think I can go back and try this again, too.
Chris's 6- and 9-year-old sons had a different reaction.
They're not that impressed with mom. They were like, Olympics, Schmampics, whatever. What it meant to them was, hey, we get to miss school for 3 weeks.
At the Sydney Olympics, Chris improved her personal best time by another 2 minutes and earned a respectable 19th place. And all these years later, Chris Clark still understands what a long shot her experience was.
It was just too exciting almost to be believed. It was, you know, if you'd been betting in Vegas, boy, I would have been a good bet. I'd have brought some money home for someone.
That story came from reporter Cherie Turner. We first learned about Chris Clark's Olympic trials upset in the Fast Women newsletter. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.